They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Corruption, international soccer, and corporate sponsorship.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the global perspective on business and the economy. Several published reports today say the Japanese entertainment and electronics giant Sony is dropping its sponsorship of World Cup Soccer. It was one of about a half dozen official partners of international soccer's governing organization, FIFA. The BBC's Russell Padmore is looking into this for us. Good morning, Russell.
Morning to you, David.
First of all, timing. Why might Sony make this move now?
Well, a lot of people are thinking, look at what's going on with the company. It's going through a big restructuring. Just maybe that $280 million it spent on sponsorship to FIFA, the world governing body of soccer and effectively tournaments like the World Cup, maybe the company has a better use for that money in the reorganization of its various divisions.
But certainly there's a wider picture here. FIFA, soccer's international governing board, is mired in controversy. Might Sony be trying to move itself out of the way of that?
We do know there are allegations of corruption that FIFA has been forced to investigate into how it issued the contracts to hold the next World Cup 2018 in Russia and then the tournament for 2022 in Qatar. Now, we've seen Emirates Airlines recently announcing it's going to end its sponsorship. We've seen reports that perhaps Coca-Cola, another major sponsor of FIFA, was disappointed into FIFA's handling of the way it carried out that investigation. They obviously don't want to be associated with allegations of corruption. Meanwhile, FIFA still finds itself in the spotlight under pressure to explain exactly what went on.
The BBC's Russell Padmore, thank you.
David, thank you.
Some fresh numbers on the real estate market in the U.S. are out later this morning as that sector continues to dig out of the chasm of the Great Recession. Some U.S. housing markets are seeing particularly strong growth thanks to foreign investors. This includes the Sun Belt, as Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
What do foreign investors see when they check out U.S. housing stock?
Affordability, straight up, you know, with multiple exclamation points.
Stan Humphries is chief economist with the online real estate firm Zillow. A report from the National Association of Realtors earlier this year found international investors spent more than $92 billion on U.S. homes, a 35% increase over last year. Humphries says some of the hottest markets in the country are Miami, New York, and Orange County. He says they can thank their housing recoveries in part on this foreign cash.
We've got a lot more international buyers in the U.S. right now than we did 8 years ago, and that's been increasing really since, say, 2011.
Still, all that Chinese and Russian money has a downside, says USC's Richard Green, like how it can make it harder on first-time home buyers.
They're pushing up the price of housing and making less housing available to others.
Prices are so high in some places, hello San Francisco, it's forcing some communities to consider workforce housing, which, if the price is right, may make a good investment. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Checking markets now, the 100-share index in London is up less than 0.2%. The DAX stock index in Germany is up 1.1%. Dow, S&P, and NASDAQ futures are up at the moment. The U.S. 10-year Treasury yield is down at 2.29%. Now, a moment of reflection about America's innovation economy. We know that in technology hubs like Silicon Valley, it's cool to fail. That's the mark of a seasoned risk-taking entrepreneur, having tried, failed, and tried again. It may also be cool to draw a mediocre salary. That's the argument of one of America's leading technology venture capitalists who says he looks for low salaries at the top of startups when he's thinking of investing. Peter Thiel was also a co-founder of PayPal and is the first outside investor in Facebook. I reached him at his offices in San Francisco. Mr. Thiel, good morning.
Good morning.
I was surprised to see in your book how much you grumble about high salaries of chief executive officers. I mean, Peter, you're a rich man, so you're not fighting class warfare here. What's your beef with a high salary?
If the CEO or the founder and the CEO get paid a large amount, it tells everyone that it's about cash and not so much about building the equity in the business. The rule of thumb I came up with was that if you paid CEOs over $150,000 a year in startup companies, they would always fail. Mark Zuckerberg, his first year running Facebook, had a salary of $55,000. Reid Hoffman at LinkedIn had a salary of $15,000. That definitely showed confidence in the business you were building.
So many people will take your point here. You know, if you're building a smaller company, a startup, maybe you need to be careful about how high a fixed salary you're giving somebody and give them stock options. But there can also be a danger about sort of following a stock price. Often, stock price can be a short-term thing. And if you're looking out for the longer-term health of a company, you have to go beyond the stock price.
That becomes a risk, especially in public companies where the stock trades and you have a temptation to push quarterly earnings up at the expense of investing in long-term growth. One of the biases I have is that people should defer IPOs as long as possible. Where in the 90s, the push was to go public as fast as possible. Today, people are willing to build businesses much longer.
So we're chatting here right about the midpoint of autumn 2014. As you look out around you now at the technology landscape, you lived through that other bubble. Are you worried about a bubble now?
I would say a full-on bubble is always a psychosocial phenomenon, and it only happens when the public gets involved, which was investing in tech IPOs in the 90s. And this time around, the public has not really been involved. And of course, you know, there's always the history. People were really burned in the 90s. And so I do think people have been a little bit more careful the second time around.
Silicon Valley venture capital man Peter Thiel. His book is called Zero to One, Notes on Startups or How to Build the Future. Thiel also prefers monopoly over competition. That's what he told me. If you missed that part of the interview on the air, it will also be at marketplace.org. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.